This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our image of war on the home front is inevitably associated with World War II, scrap metal drives, Rosie the Riveter, booming industrial growth, and the loss of so many young men at Guadalcanal, Kasserine Pass, Tarawa. 2 years after the start of the war in Iraq, equally strange-sounding names have become familiar. Fallujah, Bakuba, Mosul. But the war at home is more elusive. Today we hope you'll call to tell us how the war in Iraq affects your neighborhood, your town, your church, your business. And we'll call out to companies making new products and hiring new workers, to a state official facing a shortage of firefighters and police, to the principal of a grammar school on a military base. Those are their stories. We want to hear yours. Call and tell us how the war in Iraq affects your part of the home front. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, the Supreme Court declines to intervene in the Terry Schiavo case. But first, the war at home. We start among those most obviously affected by the war, those who fought it, and the communities they returned to. Our first guest is Brigadier General Hunt Downer of the Louisiana Army National Guard, and he joins us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And General Downer, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for having me on, sir.
Your unit is deeply enmeshed in the life of your hometown. That's a Houma, is that right?
Yes, sir. Houma, Louisiana, South Louisiana.
How many men have you lost from your town in Iraq?
Well, sir, just recently six, and it was quite tragic.
They were all friends, as I understand it.
Yes, sir, friends, and as so much. You know, the National Guard, and it's deep-rooted in the history of this country and the militia, and it comes from small towns, hometowns, all across America. And in South Louisiana, serving one's country has just been one of those things you did, you wanted to do. And our unit, C Company, or Charlie Company, of the 1st of the 156th Infantry, the 256 Brigade Combat Team, was just happened to be one of those that was hit. And they lost the Bradley vehicle, and in it were seven proud American heroes, one from New York and six from our small community in South Louisiana. And it puts a face on the war, one that you recognize because it was the young man who maybe went to school with your kids, or in my case, did go to school with some of my children, and at the same time, whose parents I went to school with, and who many of whom I knew over the years or helped recruit. It brings it home. It's a realization.
How has the community responded?
It's been amazing. Because it's a small community, a rural or urban community by today's standards, it has just been amazing. The families, you know, we always say, and they were called the black sheep. Once a member of the black sheep, always a member of the black sheep. The families have reached out. The community was always very tight-knit, very proud of its military heritage. This unit was activated, mobilized, and fought in World War II, and just amazing. And all of the families, when these soldiers, when the families came together, they said, our sons, our husbands, our loved ones, they went to school together, they played together, they trained together, they joined the service, some of them together, they were mobilized together, they went to Fort Hood together, they went to war together, they fought together, they died together, and they wanted them to come home together. And we honored that request as Louisiana Air National Guard, C-130, brought home from Dover the remains of those six American heroes from our state. And what a statement. At the same time, quite an emotional one. I need not say that.
I've not been to Houma, but I assume that somewhere in the town square there's a memorial that probably goes back to the Civil War.
Well, there is a lot of memorials at the high schools for those who died. One of the Terrebonne High School, the oldest high school there, has a memorial that lists all of the war dead from World War II, and they've added to that, and they've put up a veterans wall with everyone. You know, and in front of this particular National Guard Armory, as we talk today, are six white, small white crosses that, I'm sorry, seven. They've added one for the gentleman from New York because he is part of that unit and that heritage. T-26 to reflect and to be a constant reminder. That unit, by the way, in Houma is located across the street from a church. So there's a deep community commitment, but a strong faith, strong family ties, and an amazing support from the governor of the state, Governor Blanco, who was there when these heroes came home, to everyone, all of the elected, the public officials, the community leaders, and the families. They've reached out to help each other. What a strong. And as there were other casualties, these families go out to them and reach out to them to show the support and the strength. We're all in this together. And I think for the future, our greatest challenge as a country and for its citizens is to never forget the sacrifices of the men and women who serve our country. And when we look at that flag, we should appreciate its meaning, from the stars to the blue border, which represents the heaven to me. And I'm just giving you my impression. The stars, the states, the white represents our morality, our godliness. And yes, the red stripes do represent the bloodshed to protect us, so that today I could participate in this telephone interview conversation without fear of reprisal. We must always remember and never forget it is the soldier who gives us the freedom of press and not the poet. And we must never forget it is the soldier who gives us the freedom of speech and not the media.
General Downer, our condolences to you and the people of Houma.
Well, I just encourage everyone out there in your listening audience, if you know a service member or their family, reach out. Tell them you love them. You appreciate the sacrifice they're doing. And support them. And for the employers, thank you for saving the jobs for these young men and women when they come home, and for taking care of their families while they're deployed. We're all in this and together. And it's all about taking care of soldiers, taking care of families, so we can protect and preserve our way of life.
Brigadier General Hunt Downer of the Louisiana Army National Guard joined us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
We're talking today about the war at home. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN@NPR.org. And Sarah is with us from Pacifica, California.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Sarah.
Great. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
I thought it was such an interesting question today, the war at home. And what strikes me is that there's so little war at home from my perspective, from where I am. I live in Northern California, the bastion of the blue state, liberalism, right outside San Francisco. And most of people I know are, you know, educated, and their children are college educated. And, you know, I have one friend whose son, despite his privilege here in Northern California, has gone off and joined the Marines.
Something of a surprise, I suspect.
Absolutely. It was a surprise. It turns out he's been in the Marines for 2 years now, and he has been over in the Pacific, over in Okinawa and Japan and Hawaii. But it turns out, we just found out, he has orders that his whole platoon is going off to Afghanistan. So it just so happens I'm off from work today, and I am baking my friend's son some brownies, which is something that I don't do a lot because I'm usually at work, not usually at home baking brownies. But it's when you pose the question today, how has the war affected you at home? It's almost like it's this very abstract, amorphous thing that's going on across the world, and there's so few people I know. There's one person I know who's directly involved.
And you're sending him some brownies.
I am. And I'm also sending him a copy of the book called The Kite Runner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about Afghanistan, yes.
Absolutely. He's got to read it before he goes over there.
Sarah, thanks for the phone call.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We go now to Vermont, a state with a long but lately faltering tradition of monthly town meetings. The war in Iraq, though, has done something to reverse that decline, as many communities struggle with their views on this conflict. Vermont Secretary of State Deborah Markowitz joins us now from Castleton, Vermont. Nice of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
What's the usual business of Vermont town meetings?
Well, you know, it's Vermont town meeting occurs on the first Tuesday in March. It's been occurring there since the mid-1700s, when Vermont was a republic, before it even became a state. And generally the business is school budgets and whether or not to buy a new plow for the snow plow for the community, whether or not certain roads are going to be maintained in the winter. And
mm-hmm.
So it's the issues of governing.
And this year, though, foreign policy.
Well, foreign policy, and actually this is not the first year. Vermont has had a more recent tradition of bringing to town meetings now and then issues of national and international concern, starting in the 70s with some of the issues around nuclear proliferation and nuclear energy, and even in the 80s looking at first-strike nuclear weapons and the war in Central America, the various wars there, but this year we had a lot of attention because in 50 of our towns there was discussions about whether or not we wanted to send a message, or the voters in these meetings wanted to send a message to the president and the legislature to rethink how it's using the National Guard.
And the Vermont National Guard has certainly been used.
We are particularly hard hit, and it was interesting hearing the caller a minute ago talk about how it's very theoretical in her area. Well, Vermont is a place where we've got 600,000 people, a little bit more than that, and I would say in every school there's children whose parents have been called up, and in every community we're missing vital people, whether they're on the select board. We've got the town clerk who is in Iraq. The town clerk of one of our larger communities, Williston, is there. We're missing our police officers and firefighters, our rescue squad. It is not theoretical. It is real. There are very few of us who don't have friends or family or people we work with.
So the issue became very real at those town meetings.
It is, and what was interesting is as there was this move to get the article on the local warnings on the agenda for the town meeting, there was a conversation about how this was an act of supporting our National Guard and raising the question about what the proper balance is between the powers of the states and that of the federal government over our National Guard units.
Mm-hmm. Secretary Markowitz, can you stay with us? We have to take a short break.
I sure can.
All right. We'll be back with more with Deborah Markowitz, the Secretary of State for the state of Vermont, and hear more of your stories about the Iraq War on the home front. Has the war touched your town, your job, your congregation, or your school? How? Is your town now a sister city with a city in Iraq? Call and tell us about it. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email totn@npr.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the war on the home front, your stories about how the conflict in Iraq is changing communities, workplaces, families. If you have a story to tell, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is totn@npr.org. With us is Deborah Markowitz, Vermont's Secretary of State. Just before the break, we were talking about the Vermont town meetings. Tradition goes a long way back in that state. This year, 50 towns held the issue of Iraq's war on their agenda. And Deborah Markowitz, did these get heated?
They were very heated in some of our communities. The debate lasted over an hour, and you have to picture this. You know, people are sitting around a town hall, a public, you know, one of the big rooms or in a gym at a school, on chairs and standing up, taking turns in front of a mic, and it's a tremendous diverse representation of who lives in the communities. It's not like it's all peaceniks or all people who themselves are members of the Guard or have friends in the Guard. And so it's diverse, and so people stand up and speak their mind, speak from their experience. The debate in many places was quite impassioned, and in some communities they amended the article. They amended what they were going to be supporting. They changed the language until the meeting was comfortable with what they were all going to be voting on. I think the basic message, though, and so this was 50 communities out of about 240, and so you know, it wasn't the majority of communities, but it was a diverse representation of the communities, had an argument and came out with the message of saying, you know, we want to relook at how we're using our guard units. We're too hard hit. We want to make sure that we have support here at home if there's a disaster. Now, of course, you know, about half of our guardsmen and women have been called up, which does leave us quite a few here to help in case of national emergency. I feel confident that we're well cared for. But I think what the debate showed was the reality in our communities that we feel the loss. And, you know, you may know, the listeners may be aware that Vermont is a state where the war in Iraq was not popular. You know, the vast majority of Vermonters were against going there in the first place. That's not to say everybody was. I mean, there's still a significant number who think it was the right choice. I think that colored the debate as well.
Deborah Markowitz, thanks very much. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Deborah Markowitz is Vermont Secretary of State, and she joined us from Castleton College in Castleton, Vermont. And let's get another caller on the line. Lynn is with us from Lake Tahoe.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in a small community. Tahoe City is a city with one traffic light. It's a city in name only, and I can see how it is that our fire department, our police, and a good number of townspeople have been affected by this.
I assume a percentage of the fire department and the police department of members of the National Guard or reserves, they're off?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm also the mother of a National Guardsman who happens to be serving in Guantanamo. And when I asked him what it was he would like to have me send him, his response was that everybody wants books. It's not the brownies, not the comestibles, but reading material was really critical.
Any kind of books in particular?
Oh, I think primarily escapist novels, mysteries, things that, not war books.
and not books of heavy analysis of foreign policy or anything like that?
Well, I wanted to send him Richard Clark's book, but he and I have major disagreements. I was a war protester. It was rather interesting, parenthetically, although I'd gone to several demonstrations, mostly in Carson City at the Capitol, on the day that we actually went into Iraq, I remember passing by a large group of people that were having a different type of demonstration, and I raised the sunroof of my car and put through my hand up with this V sign. And as I did so, I realized it was totally ambiguous because I am supporting our troops. I was just against the war. And I didn't really know, is this V for victory? Is this peace? I didn't even know what I was expressing. But people, nonetheless, would respond on the basis of whatever they assumed I was expressing. And so some would glower, some would smile. But it was interesting in how communication really isn't.
Lynn, thank you. Appreciate the phone call.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Jane. Jane's in a car phone in Philadelphia.
Yes, I am. And I think I've just lost you, unfortunately. I'm a Marine mom, and my son is returning shortly from his second tour of duty over in Iraq. And one of the things that the community did to support him was that his former pastor put together a collection of soccer balls and other equipment to be sent over to the children in Ramadi. And that equipment has finally landed in Ramadi, and fortunately my son is coming home. Unfortunately, he won't be there to be able to distribute it, but it was one of the things that they did to keep the kids rather playing soccer rather than firing guns at the Marines.
And so that was sent over by the community?
It was sent over by the community of Glastonbury and some people in Farmington, Connecticut, yes. And fortunately, my company was able to palletize and wrap the equipment because it was a tremendous amount of equipment. And there's another company, Spirit of America, that was able to ship it over through FedEx to get it over there for them.
And when's your son due home?
He is leaving Iraq today, and I am ecstatic.
I can understand that. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for the phone call.
Take care.
The military is testing a new technology they hope will help servicemen and women who return from Iraq with post-traumatic stress disorder. To tell us more about it, joining us now is James Spira, the lead investigator in the virtual reality study. Nice of you to be with us today, James Spira.
Thanks, Neil.
Tell us how this new technology works.
Well, to some extent, it's really not new technology. Psychotherapy has been used for patients with post-traumatic stress disorder from a variety of different causes for years, and it's been shown to be really quite effective, especially what we call exposure therapy. Exposure therapy is when you teach someone how to relax, focus in the moment, be comfortable in their body, and then gradually expose them to triggers that previously would send them off and cause quite a bit of arousal.
So relive the experience.
To some extent, but relive it in a new way.
Hmm.
The problem is, for our returning troops, for example, a backfire from a car, somebody yelling suddenly behind them, aircraft going overhead, can trigger pretty horrendous memories and feelings. What we're doing now with this new technology is using virtual reality environments to progressively introduce those type of elements.
So,
but at the same time, teaching the troops how to relax, be comfortable, focus in the moment so they can better tolerate those.
So they go on through a virtual Baghdad or a virtual Fallujah?
That's right. Exactly. We have a virtual city that our partners in this research at the University of Southern California Institute for Creative Technologies is developing that actually scans in scenes from Fallujah, scenes from medical tents and convoys, so that we can gradually expose these troops to them as they're able to tolerate it.
And
eventually, these things won't bother them anymore.
I can understand. Obviously, they've got the visual component and the sound, but there's a lot more to the experience than just that.
There is. We're also going to be introducing some heat. We'll have a fan blowing heat on them because, as you know, it's quite hot over there and dry.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have smells, burning tires, even burning flesh, some of them say. But it's not that we have to introduce them to the exact same stimulus they had. All we have to do is trigger their memories, which doesn't take a whole lot, frankly, at this point. They had such horrendous experiences that we just want to be able to trigger those memories so that they can learn to gain mastery over them rather than have those thoughts and feelings control them.
How's it working?
It works pretty well. We teach them how to relax. We use biofeedback so we can monitor their physiological reactions. We talk to them about what's going on so we get the subjective reactions. We teach them how to relax, be comfortable in a couple sessions, and then we start introducing these images in the virtual world that they can move around, they can interact in, for about 8 to 9 sessions. At the end of that time, they tend to do pretty well.
Hmm. And what's the feedback from the men and women who have been using this equipment?
Well, this is the early stages, and we're really developing the software now, but the early feedback is, wow, this is pretty realistic. We don't want to make it absolutely realistic. We want to make it somewhat cartoonish so that they don't feel overly immersed. We want them to have a sense of distance from these images and from these feelings. It's just enough to trigger their automatic reactions so they can make them under their control. It works pretty well.
Yeah. Interestingly, the military used virtual realities of Baghdad, for example, to help train troops before the war to give them an idea of what they would experience when they went into Iraqi cities. And now you're doing the same thing in a way on the way out.
That's exactly right. In fact, a lot of the games that are around that kids use and PlayStations and Xboxes have been developed initially by the military for these trainings and exposures, almost like flight simulators to train pilots. And we're turning that around now and helping the troops be able to adapt better to their return back to the States.
James Spira, thanks very much.
Sure. Happy to talk with you.
James Spira is head of the Health Psychology Division at the Navy Medical Center in San Diego, California, lead investigator on the military's virtual reality studies. We're talking today about the war at home, and here's an email we got from Jessica. Like your previous caller, I grew up in California, where many of my friends continue to view the war as something happening on a distant planet. When my brother, a member of the Coast Guard, was deployed to serve in Iraq, I asked him what I could do to help. His response was, volunteer at a VA hospital. It took me just one phone call to find one near where I now live in Boston. What most amazed and saddened me was the profound gratitude expressed by the volunteer coordinator, who has told me how few people have stepped forward to do something similar. Volunteering can take many forms, but few Americans take the time. I'd like to encourage everyone to realize that no matter what our views on the war, our servicemen and women need our support, and they need it before, during, and after deployment. Every American can participate in this support. In fact, it ought to be their duty. For a look at the impact the war has had on some of those too young to serve, we turn now to Frank Gomez, principal of Santa Margarita Elementary School at the main Marine Corps' Camp Pendleton in Southern California. We've spoken with Principal Gomez a few times over the past few years. It's nice to have you back on the Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be back with you.
We talked to you almost exactly 2 years ago, I guess, on the eve of the war. 2 years in, has parental deployment become routine for your students?
Oh, very much so. It's a way, if you will, it's a way of life here at Camp Pendleton and especially on our school site at Santa Margarita.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of your kids have parents in Iraq?
I would say at this time, the numbers have lowered over the years. We probably are sitting at about anywhere from 10 to 25% at any given time.
So a fair amount.
Yes, very much so. The impact of parents leaving, the impact of parents coming back from Iraq is a constant activity that we certainly deal with day to day here at Santa Margarita.
I wonder, do the kids counsel each other even at that young age? A kid whose parent has come back telling another kid whose parent is away, hey, you know, hang in.
Very much so. Very much so. We found, unlike the past, at one point, and when I first spoke to NPR 2 years ago, we were sitting close to 50% of our school that had the children had one parent or in some cases both parents gone. In this particular time, we have such a mobility of parents coming and going that students are talking with each other, talking with their peers, saying, hey, my dad came back, and I'm sure yours is coming back shortly, because it is a revolving door here at Santa Margarita.
We're talking today about the war at home. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Principal Gomez, just by the letters of the numbers of calculation, I assume you must have lost a few parents.
Well, and we have lost some over the years, and certainly that is never an easy thing to deal with as a school site. And when one of your parents is one that is dies in the war, it affects the whole community. The manner in which it affects it varies. Recently, we had a parent who in August died in late July, died in Iraq. And when we came back in August, although it was weeks later, it was one in which the community here at Santa Margarita, the parents especially, rallied around the family and extended any way that they could to support this family.
Are they being remembered?
Very much so. One of the things, and we have a parent-teacher organization made up of some dynamite parents, and one in particular, our president of our PTO, Angela Walls, who created the idea to have what we've established as a bird bath. And what it is it's a bird bath that sits in a critical area of our entrance, and a plaque that we're going to be putting on it that it says, in remembrance of all of our fallen heroes.
Frank Gomez, thanks as always. We appreciate your time today.
And thank you for the time, and thank you for remembering our kids in this time of need as well.
Frank Gomez, principal of the Santa Margarita Elementary School on the base at Camp Pendleton in North San Diego County, California, and he joined us from his office at the school. Let's get another caller on the line, and Brett is with us from Laramie, Wyoming.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm a chief officer in a fire department in our town here, and we're a really small organization. And we've had two people deployed, and now they are coming back off their deployments. And we have, over the last 18 months, haven't been able to, obviously we had to bring somebody into the organization as small as we are. Now we're having to, we're fortunate that we're not having to kick them out, but I'm thinking there's got to be tons of organizations out there that are in the same situation, that they're putting people back out into the unemployment lines. I was wondering if any of your experts had anything to say on that.
Well, we'll see if anybody calls in with a similar experience. But you replace these firefighters when they went off to Iraq, and fortunately now you have jobs for them when they come home, but you got other people there too.
That's correct. Yeah, fortunately, through retirements, we're going to be able to keep those people on, but I'm thinking there's got to be tons of people out there that aren't going to be so fortunate.
Yeah. Difficult situation. I suspect you're really glad you're not finding yourself in the position of having to let people go.
Absolutely. We've spent 18 months hiring and training these people. Tremendous expense to the organization, and they're great people, and we certainly don't want to let them go.
Well, congratulations to your returning firefighters.
All right. Thank you very much, Neil.
Appreciate the phone call.
Bye-bye.
When we come back from a short break, we'll talk with one company that's gone from making steam tables to armoring military vehicles, and we'll learn more about the Supreme Court's decision today not to hear the case of Terry Schiavo. That's after the break. If you have your stories about war on the home front for us, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and here are the headlines from some of the stories we're following today here at NPR News. The high school in Red Lake, Minnesota, will be closed at least two more weeks. Authorities are still trying to determine the motive for the shootings that left 10 people dead at the Red Lake Indian Reservation in Minnesota on Monday. And BP officials now say 15 people died in yesterday's oil refinery explosion in Texas. They were performing maintenance work when the blast occurred. You can hear details on those stories and, of course, much more later today on All Things Considered from NPR News. Tomorrow, it's Science Friday. Ira Flato will be here with a roundup of the latest science news from a plant that can rewrite its own genetic code to one that can create antibodies to anthrax. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Today we're hearing stories from around the country about how the war in Iraq is playing out on the home front, and we'd appreciate your phone calls. 800-989-8255. Email is totn@npr.org. Unlike previous conflicts, this war has not involved any vast industrial ramp-up, but life has changed at some companies. Imagine you run a small family business making a specialized product. One day the military calls you up and tells you you have a new job to outfit vehicles for Iraq. James Philip Poole is president of the American Metal Fabricators in Frederick, Maryland, and he joins us now. Thanks for being with us today.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. What was your company making before?
We make merchandisers for grocery stores and commercial kitchen equipment. Food preparation equipment.
Steam tables, that sort of thing?
Dish tables, sinks, and cafeteria counters.
And how'd you end up as a military contractor?
Well, it was really quite by accident. We work with a company over in Virginia that sells glass to us for our salad bars. We buy 10 or 15,000 a month from them on average. And whenever they need something metal, they come to us. Whenever I need something glass, I go to them. And they came to me with the idea that they had a chance to bid on the Hummer windshields, and they wanted to know if I could make a frame that would be heavy enough to hold a 75-pound piece of glass in a Hummer hitting an 8-inch curb at 80 miles an hour.
Huh. So you've had to change your whole outlook a little bit.
Yeah, it's lucky. At the time, we have been making big investments in CNC machines and full modeling of parts, to where once you get a 3D model in a computer, the machine will make the part. So all we had to do was the 3D model the Hummer windshield frame into the computer, and then model the glass in there, then model the frame around it, would hold it in, and then it goes into software programs that flatten the metal up. I can show you what shape it's going to be. You just send it to a machine, and it punches away the metal you don't want, and the power brakes bend it up on the right angles to hold it in, and you end up with the piece, and you just weld it into the shape that it's in that it takes to go around the windshield, and all the whole bolt holes would be in the right place, and the part would be missing where the windshield wiper arm goes through. And then we had to just make a piece, and the Army had to test it.
Yeah. Now, I don't mean to denigrate to kitchen equipment, but the stuff you're making now is probably saving lives.
Yes, and everybody around the shop, well, we got the order, the first part of the order last summer when we were normally busy trying to open schools and college cafeterias, and we only had 6 weeks to make the first batch of something like 1,200. And that's vehicles, and there's two windshields in every vehicle, so we had to make 2,400 frames. And so we had to work time and a half over the weekend, and which is in the summertime when people in southern Maryland, people like to go crabbing and fishing and
sure.
picking tomatoes in the summertime. So we had to pay them overtime. Or we normally have to pay them double time to work any overtime.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as they found out that it was something to defend the troops, they all just volunteered to work all weekend if we wanted.
James Philip Poole, thank you for your time today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
James Philip Poole is president of American Metal Fabricators. He joined us from their offices in Prince Frederick in the southern part of Maryland. Here's an email we got from Adriana Farley in Durham, California. Our son came home after a year at Balad Camp Anaconda with the California National Guard attached to the 81st Brigade. He turned 20 the day after returning home. The outpouring of support from our very small town of Durham, California was phenomenal. We expect the same brownie baking and prayers and officers' support when my husband is deployed and anticipated leaving mid-September for a one-year tour in Baghdad. The support by fellow parishioners, community members, the 4-H Club, the high school continues to the others. There are currently 19 serving in various armed services, continues without let-up. We only know of goodness and caring via the support we as a family have received. Let's get another caller on the line. And this is John. John's calling from Watertown, New York.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well. Watertown, New York, Camp Drum, if memory serves.
Yes. My unit, we just returned from Iraq. We were in Baqaba for a little over a year. And I think part of the hard part of coming back to community is just readapting to life in the United States after you've been over there.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of hard to explain, but when you go from a combat situation where you have people shooting you, killing or trying to kill you, and then you come back to the community, there's been an adjustment period there.
Do you find yourself having difficulty relaxing?
Yeah. You're still on edge when you get back. I mean, my hometown has been great. They've gone out of their way to thank you, support us. It's been incredible, the amount of support that we received.
Where are you from?
I'm from Warren, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. So Watertown, New York, spring is no different there than it is in New Hampshire, I suspect.
No, it's the same.
As you go around town, there was a feeling by a lot of veterans returning from Vietnam that their people were unhappy with them. Do you get that feeling at all?
No, we don't. And I know a lot of Vietnam vets have gone out of their way to make sure that when we come back, that they're there to meet us and they welcome us. And organizations like the VFW or the American Legion, AMVET, sending out packages, and always trying to keep in contact with deployed soldiers, seeing if there's anything they can do. They've helped out quite a bit.
Well, John, good luck. It does get easier.
Oh, I'm sure it will.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. And sure. Thanks to everybody who called to participate and give us stories about what's happening in their towns and the war at home.